The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 361, a paper entitled Seeing Joseph Smith, Visual and Verbal Images of the Mormon Prophet. The presenter is Robert A. Rees. The respondent is Ron Romig.
We'd like to welcome you to session 361, Seeing Joseph Smith, Visual and Verbal Images of the Mormon Prophet, by Robert Rees and respondent Ron Romig. First, I would just like to mention to turn off all cell phones. First, I'd like to introduce Robert Rees. Robert Rees is from Brookdale, California, and has published a variety of perspectives on the Book of Mormon. He is a member of the Book of Mormon Symposium at BYU and is editor of a collection of essays on the Book of Mormon to be published by Signature Books in 2007. Mr. Rees is the former assistant dean of the College of Fine Arts at UCLA and current visiting scholar at the Claremont Graduate University Center for Arts and Humanities. He is director of Education and Humanities at the Institute of Heart Math in Boulder Creek, California. The respondent is Ron Romig. And Mr. Romig is the archivist for the Community of Christ Church in Independence, Missouri. Mr. Rees.
Thank you. To begin with, I'd like to express appreciation to a number of people who were helpful in gathering images that you will see today: the Church Historian's Office, the Church Museum of Art, the Community of Christ, and particularly Ron Romig, who I'm pleased will respond to my presentation today, and to a number of individual artists and authors. The task of seeing Joseph Smith, whether in the flesh or in the imagination, begins with how he saw and presented the first of his dramatic experiences, his first vision, in which he saw God the Father and Jesus Christ, not in a dream or in his imagination or as spectral images, but as real corporeal beings. His testimony that such beings existed and that they spoke personally to him from the very beginning determined how others saw him, either as a foolish, deluded farm boy possessed of an evil spirit, or as a new prophet called to usher in the last dispensation of Christ's kingdom. Thus, Joseph Smith's portrayal of personages he saw determined how he himself would be seen for the next nearly 200 years. Interestingly, Joseph's description of Christ, even though he testified that what he saw was, quote, beyond all description, was in some detail quite specific. Later, in describing what he saw to Alexander Nebar, who recorded it in his journal, Smith said he saw, quote, a fire toward heaven come near and nearer, saw a personage in the fire, light complexion, blue eyes, a piece of white cloth drawn over his shoulders, his right arm bare. On another occasion, asked to describe the Jesus he had seen in vision, Joseph Smith is reported to have said, to begin with, he has blue eyes. This immediate, confident answer suggests that what Joseph saw was grounded in concrete experience of some specific dimension. How did Joseph Smith's contemporaries see him? How did he see himself? How do we see him today? The images we will see today will not give a full view of the complex and diverse ways in which people have viewed and still view the prophet, but I hope they will at least suggest that in some ways it is hard to see the many sides of Joseph Smith by looking at a single image, or for that matter, at all of the images of him put together. In reality, Joseph Smith, at this 200th anniversary of his birth, remains a complex, enigmatic, and even somewhat mysterious figure. In his seminal and provocative book and film, Ways of Seeing, on how we read paintings or other graphic images, John Berger suggests that how we see a painting depends more on what we bring to it than does the painting itself. As Berger states, the relation between what we see and what we know is never settled. The way we see things is affected by what we know or what we believe. We never look at one thing. We are always looking at the relation between things and ourselves. Every image embodies a way of seeing. Our perception or appreciation of an image depends also upon our own way of seeing. End of quote. Thus, how we regard Joseph Smith, for example, whether we see him as a prophet or an impostor, will influence how we see graphic representations of him. One of Berger's arguments is that our culture prejudices the way in which we view paintings or other graphic images. Another of his salient points is that we sometimes see what we are conditioned or told to see, that we are influenced by others' ways of seeing. This reminds me of the story of the art professor who was taking a class on a tour of Europe. In one museum, he showed his students a medieval sculpture of a raven. One of his co-eds said, "That's not my idea of a raven," to which the professor said, "Young woman, that's God's idea of a raven." Berger illustrates a fundamental truth about our ocular perception. It remains highly subjective. Dennis, would you hit the B on my computer right there? The B, as in Bob. Thank you. For example, the way you respond to this graphic may be influenced by any number of things. If you knew nothing of the graphic artist who rendered this image of Joseph Smith, and I told you it was designed for an anti-Mormon website, you would probably see it differently than if I told you it was commissioned by the church as a symbol for its new Joseph Smith website. In actuality, it is neither. If you recognize the graphic from the cover of Dan Vogel's new biography of Joseph Smith, then how you responded to it will to some extent be influenced by whether you feel Vogel's treatment of the prophet is fair and balanced or unfair and distorted. Personally, I see the image. If I can get back up here. Personally, I see the image in a neutral way and feel it is an apt symbol of what I hope to say today. I'll say why at the end of my remarks. How was Joseph Smith seen by his contemporaries? Two examples suggest the polar views that dominated his own time and continue to dominate ours. The first comes from the Palmyra Reflector of February 1, 1831. Quote, "In his person, he is tall and slender, thin-favored, having but little expression of countenance other than that of dullness. His mental powers appear to be extremely limited, and from the small opportunity he has had of school, he has made little or no proficiency." The second is from Lydia Bailey Knight, an early convert. "Next morning, many were the curious glances that I cast at this strange man who dared to call himself a prophet. I saw a tall, well-built form with the carriage of an Apollo, brown hair, handsome blue eyes, which seemed to dive down to the innermost thoughts with their sharp, penetrating gaze, a striking countenance and with manners at once majestic yet gentle, dignified yet exceedingly pleasant." Such divergent views of the prophet continue in our day. Contemporary literature, as well as a plethora of information on the internet, is full of verbal images on the one hand of Joseph Smith as charlatan, deceiver, devil, possessed, and emotionally disturbed. One critic calls him the egomaniacal prophet. Another identifies him as Joseph Smith, a warlock. Latter-day Saint Lynn Ridenour wrote to 100 evangelical Christians asking them for their view of the prophet. His summary was, "None were favorable toward the man. All of them considered Joseph Smith to be either an impostor, egoist, plagiarist, or fanatic." Contrast this with what one reads and sees on the new church's new Joseph Smith website. There, Joseph is presented as the idealized version of a prophet, a person in keeping with the statement of the Doctrine and Covenants that he has, quote, "done more than any person save Jesus Christ for the salvation of souls." As Lynn Mafley Kipp said in the opening lecture for this symposium, to an outsider it seems as if Mormons see Joseph Smith as a sanctified person. But increasingly non-Mormons are beginning to see Joseph Smith in a more positive light. Perhaps none is as extravagant as that of the agnostic Harold Bloom, one of the preeminent critics of our time, who said, "I myself can think of not another American except for Emerson and Whitman who so moves and alters my imagination. So self-educated was he that he transcends Emerson and Whitman in my imaginative response and takes his place with the great figures of our fiction, since at moments he appears larger than life in the mode of a Shakespearean character, so rich and varied a personality, so vital a spark of divinity, is almost beyond the limits of the human as we normally construe those limits." Nearly subhuman, nearly beyond the limits of the human. The history of art suggests that it is a common human tendency to idealize great figures. Take Jesus, for example. Isaiah said that, quote, "He should have no beauty that we should desire him." And yet, except for some representations by certain medieval artists, Jesus is generally portrayed as beautiful or handsome, as a kind of ideal male figure. What did Jesus really look like? We don't know. As Edgar Snow observes, the earliest known depictions of Jesus show him as a young, smooth-shaven shepherd. Later artists show Jesus wearing a beard. The model for our current pictures presenting him as a sage or philosopher. Yet, for all we know, Jesus may have in fact been balding, less than muscular, short, and otherwise nondescript. Hanging in the Tate Museum in London is a painting by a modern British artist that shows Jesus crossing a London street. Although he has a beard and is dressed in a long robe and is therefore distinct from all those around him, no one sees him. It is as if he were invisible, which is perhaps what he would be were he to walk among us. One wonders if Joseph Smith were to appear on the streets of Salt Lake City today, either in his 19th century garb or dressed like a general authority, whether anyone would recognize him. We have lived with idealized portraits of him for so long that I would guess that most would not. As John Henry Evans observed many years ago, the Joseph Smith of the popular imagination is no more a reality than Santa Claus or Uncle Sam. As to what the prophet actually or approximately looked like, we have a number of descriptions from his mainly sympathetic contemporaries. Ephraim Hatch, who did considerable research both on verbal and visual portrayals of the prophet for an article in The Ensign, which was later expanded into a book, summarizes these accounts as follows. People say that he was a good-looking man, at least 6 feet tall, with a youthful appearance. He weighed between 180 and 220 pounds. He had a broad, muscular chest and shoulders, which in later years were slightly round. He had small hands. I keep going ahead of myself here. He has small hands, large feet, and long legs. His head was large, oblong, oval in shape. His hair was fine, not curly, and light brown, changing to auburn in later years. His eyes, light hazel or blue, were set far apart, deep in the head, and were shaded by long, thick eyelashes. Some said they were the longest eyelashes. His face had a pleasant expression with an unconscious smile. His upper lip was full and a little protruding. His chin was broad and square, with very little beard. His forehead was sloping and unfurrowed. His complexion was light, sometimes called pale. He was unusually well dressed, generally in black, with a white necktie. Hatch concluded that the most authoritative portrait was a full-length profile rendered by Sutcliffe, Maudsley, and Nauvoo in the early 1840s. Maudsley, a British convert who came to Nauvoo in 1842, did several representations of the prophet and his brother Hiram, as well as of the prophet alone. In this slide, showing Joseph and Hiram side by side in right-facing profiles, one gets a portrait of Joseph essentially in contrast to Hiram. But the presentation, even though in places Joseph is in the preeminent front position, shows the brothers in a rather equal light. There are subtle differences, however. Notice, for example, how much broader Joseph's chest is than his brother's. Joseph is more elegantly dressed than Hiram, with a frock that has more buttons, with what looks like spats, with a ring in a more prominent position. Notice also the difference in their stances. Jairus is more static than Joseph's. Joseph's left leg is bent forward. His hand rests confidently on his walking stick, and with the walking stick planted firmly alongside his leg, conveys energy and confidence. Motley's next rendition of the brothers presents a more dramatic contrast. Here the brothers face one another. Oh, it didn't change. It's showing on my computer, but it's not showing there. Pardon? Just put the arrow, the down arrow, over to the right. Oh. Now, there we go. Go back one more. Now. There. There. Okay. Thank you. So how do I do that? There we go.
Now, it's not changing on the screen.
Oh, it's still
not.
We're at the mercy of technology here, folks. Can you move it? Can it go forward or backward? There we go. Okay. Yes. Here the brothers face one another. The portrait of Hiram with his button coat, more reserved stance, with his hands together, and his walking stick touching the ground, suggests a more conservative nature, perhaps one given to following rather than leading. By contrast, Joseph is shown with open coat, hand on hip, more open contrapposed stance, and a walking stick that disappears at an angle behind his right leg. Joseph's entire physique is larger and more broadly, boldly presented than Hiram's, suggesting the difference between prophet and disciple. This was the stance I was looking at. In another modulated portrait of the prophet is seen in a bold fashion, but this is not the right one. I switched these slides around. Okay, so what we are seeing is Maudsley's presentation of Joseph Smith in military attire. There you can see the rather prominent nose of the prophet, which as we come into the 20th and 21st century will disappear. My wife called me today from Idaho, where she's visiting, and said, "I just heard an interesting story you should share in your presentation." Some friends of ours were in art school in Los Angeles a number of years ago, and the wife of the couple was working for Rosemary Reed, who was a Mormon designer of bathing suits. And so Rosemary Reed had her doing some of the graphic work for her. Rosemary Reed at this time is also very involved in a movement in the church to convert Jews to the church. And in order to proselytize a number of her Jewish associates in the garment industry, she had our friend take the old Joseph Smith pamphlet and redesign it to give Joseph Smith a more prominent nose so he would look more Jewish. So the nose disappeared, and then it came back at least for a short while. Maudsley's portraits of Joseph Smith influenced a number of artists and illustrators in the 19th century who did renditions of the prophet. And this is either possibly Maudsley. Ron is not sure, and Ron knows a lot more about these than I do. This may be a painting, an oil painting of the prophet by Maudsley. And then you can begin to see Maudsley's influence in a number of portraits of Joseph Smith that come into the latter part of the 19th century. These are variations on a theme, actually, until you get to this, which is also a contemporary portrait of the prophet, the first full-facing portrait that that we have. These early portraits present Joseph Smith as a rather static personality. While they capture some of the prophet's distinctive physical characteristics, as I mentioned, his prominent nose, his muscular chest, and in some, his almost feminine features, not much of his inner personality is conveyed by these. In this particular slide, however, we see Joseph Smith in a full frontal position, it's more difficult to see his nose than it is in the profile. Here we see much more of the, what I would say is the mystery or the enigma of Joseph as he looks out straight at us. There was a daguerreotype taken, which some have confused with an actual daguerreotype or early photographic image of Joseph Smith, which Ron and other scholars say is really just a daguerreotype of the photo itself. Here are just a couple of slides showing Joseph Smith in more heroic stances, on his horse, in front of the Nauvoo Legion, preaching to the Indians. Here's another one of him doing that. You can see the kind of grand gestures and the very static stance. This portrait, which is based somewhat on this one, is the beginning of what I would call one of the trends in the portrayal of Joseph Smith as a in a more feminine light. That is, the more muscular, masculine features begin to disappear. This is a supposed portrait of Joseph Smith that was done in the late 19th century. It is of doubtful authenticity. We don't know that it is him, but some people claim it was. This particular one done around the end of the 19th century, Ron? The same artist doing this one right around the turn of the century, either late 19th or early 20th century. Again, you can see Maudsley's influence on the prophet. As we come into the 20th century, notice the ways in which Joseph begins to be transformed. Now this particular one I think is interesting because the look in Joseph's eyes suggests possibly something, if not sly or sinister, at least approaching that. And the look in his eye is certainly very different than we have in others. This particular slide by Gittins, 1950s, I think, 1956, commissioned by the church, becomes for the next probably 30 or 40 years the dominant image of Joseph Smith that we see. I want you to pay particular attention to the contrast between this and the earlier images. Here you see the prophet almost like Lorenzo de' Medici, very much like the portraits we have of Renaissance noble men and noble women. The hand on the hip, the very confident look, notice the parallel image, if I can get this laser thing to work, parallel image between this, his hand on this side, the sheaf of papers on the other, both of them suggesting a kind of openness, a boldness, a confidence in the prophet that, again, is almost impossible to see in some of the early portrayals of him. As I mentioned, this becomes the dominant image and is imitated in lots of different ways, including this one on velvet done by an unknown Tijuana artist, this one done by Gary Schertz, a Mormon who works in wood. Then we come into another. The image I just showed you. Would you take that one back? It's difficult to go back on this. Just push the back arrow. That one. This is an interesting portrait from my point of view because it's the first one that presents Joseph Smith in kind of a frontier garb and a frontier setting. instead of on a horse in front of the Nauvoo Legion or preaching nobly to the Indians, here he's just seen surrounded by disciples, although the one disciple over to the right looks somewhat skeptical at him, suggesting perhaps something of the complexity with which some of his contemporaries may have seen him. This particular portrait done by a Latter-day Saint artist from South Carolina, Joseph Smith, is very clear, front and center. His white shirt pulls all of the attention toward him. But again, his look, which is looking over to the side, somewhat mysterious and somewhat different from the surrounding area. This is another head rendition. He did a number of different versions of the prophet. This is also his of the prophet in a later time. Here we see Joseph Smith done by late 20th century, early 21st century artists in his much more idealized stance. Here he becomes very different from the prophet we saw in the early pictures. Peggy Fletcher Stack observed recently, as he gets closer to his 200th birthday, Joseph Smith has grown more handsome. In modern portraits, we would hope that would happen to all of us, right? In modern portraits and films, the Mormon Church's founder's large nose, Napoleonic hairstyle, and stout belly had given way to the leaner, tanner look of a California surfer. He seems less remote and more like us. While that is true in one way, in another way, the prophet has become more remote. The more we idealize and romanticize him, the more we smooth over his rough edges, the more we edit out or explain away his weaknesses and even his failures, the less he is like us, and therefore the less we are able to identify him. This portrait by Dell Parsons, for example, portrays Joseph Smith as an almost transcendent person. One observer on the internet suggested that the similarity of Parsons' portrait of Joseph with that of Parsons' portrait of Jesus represents a conscious or unconscious desire to link the Mormon prophet with the Savior. In a comment entitled "Ripped Jesus" on the internet, one observer said, "Apparently the artist, Dale Parsons, although wildly talented as an artist, believed that Jesus had enough time to fit in at least 2 hours of gym time a day between performing miracles and saving humanity from their depravity. From his broad shoulders to his cascading beard, he was all man." A departure from the trend to represent Joseph as heroic or angelic is the following by recent convert Mark Inman. "In commenting on this portrait, I wrote to Inman and said, 'Tell me what you had in mind when you did this.' And he said, 'I'm a self-taught painter. I started painting in July of 2003 and had my first show that October. The reason I painted the prophet the way I did was to help bring the culture of the church into today's world. I believe that many depictions of the prophet don't show his real humanity, that they are merely propaganda pieces or that they only depict him at his greatest moments. But Smith was human, and I wanted to bring him to a place that people can relate to him and say, 'I've had days like that.' The painting fragments Joseph's face, and it uses different color tones in each fragment. Why did I paint him this way? I'm sure there are a million reasons. In fact, the subject is so complicated, there could be a whole chapter in a book dedicated to this one piece and my relationship to it. Long story short, I was not sure of my placement in the church. I was baptized almost a year earlier, and I had come out of a hospital from a series of chronic illnesses. The portrait was my attempt at trying to be part of the church's culture in a way that I loved. I saw so many open-minded people in the church, but at the same time, no one was doing anything of much interest to me artistically. So I wanted to change that. Will I ever do another portrait of him? I don't know. I don't have an answer as to why there are so few modernist portrayals of Joseph Smith, but I do know that my portrayal was done with the deepest respect for the prophet and speaks to many in the church that Mormon culture is changing and entering the real world. While the images of Joseph Smith in the 19th century tended to be repetitive and variations on Maudsley's renditions from life, and those of the 20th century tended to become more romanticized and idealized, so the 21st century may present us with a more varied gallery of images of the prophet. Let's hope they are not limited to the following. Some of you know this Joseph Smith is Sphinx. It's in a garden a few blocks from here, done by a bishop who was a brickmason, somebody said. Some of you are familiar with Joseph Smith from South Park. The most bizarre image of Joseph Smith that I've come across, however, is this one. Here you see Joseph Smith, along with all of the other prophets of the this dispensation, and the Savior in the middle. And it makes me wonder whether or not President Hinckley, whose picture is on here, would revise his idea about tattooing if he could see this one. The long beard over here, that's Joseph F. Smith, I believe, isn't it? I can't see it from this angle. Anyway, this is apparently all of the prophets of this dispensation. The renditions may not be accurate enough to recognize all of them. Would you hit the B button on that for just a moment? To illustrate how individuals may react to vastly different ways to a common image, I cite an episode from Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Ahab, in his megalomaniacal quest for the white whale, nails a gold doubloon to the mast of the ship as a reward to the first man who sights the whale. As they seek the elusive Leviathan, each of the characters on the ship comes up and looks at the doubloon, and each sees something different. For Ahab, it is the prophetic emblem of his quest. For Starbuck, it is a Puritan sermon. For Stubb, it is an almanac of the zodiac. For Flask, the pragmatist, it is but a round thing made of gold. Ron, I still have a few to show, so don't switch over yet. For Queequeg, it is merely an old button off a king's trousers. Finally, for Ahab, it is the image of the rounder globe. I close my presentation with a collection of paintings from Mormon artist Liz Lemon Swindle from her book Joseph Smith, Impressions of a Prophet. You can hit the B again. I find Swindle's work refreshing. Because she shows Joseph Smith in a much more human context, in a broader array of experiences, including domestic, from his surprise at Moroni's visit to his role as son, father, and husband, to his courageous acceptance of the road to Carthage. It's the tarring and feathering of Joseph Smith, the reception of the Melchizedek priesthood, embracing his father, whom he has just baptized. I think it's a lovely image. This is Joseph Smith up in the night when Emma was with another one of their twins, who, of course, we know tragically died. But Joseph Smith as a father in the middle of the night taking care of his infant daughter. Joseph Smith playing with his children. Joseph Smith sawing wood with people, giving a blessing. Joseph Smith in Liberty Jail asking God if he has forsaken him, and then rising to the nobility of the great speech which Parley Pratt has memorialized. I showed that one. Joseph embracing Emma before he goes to Carthage, and then her image of called my servant Joseph. You can leave that image up unless you want to change. You want to change to yours, you can do that. A number of years ago, reflecting attitudes that had predominated for a century and a half, Joseph Fielding Smith stated, Joseph Smith was either a prophet of God, divinely called, properly appointed and commissioned, or he was one of the biggest frauds the world has ever seen. There is no middle ground. Most of us today would not see such polar choices. With the new Mormon history, we know that much more about Joseph Smith than did Latter-day Saints of any previous generation, perhaps even including his own. We know the prophet to be a much more complex personality than he has been presented in traditional and official church publications. Excuse me, Ron, I do want to go back. Sorry to do this to you, but I want to go back to that initial image that I had, which is... it should be the last one. That one. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. We know the prophet to be a much more complex personality than he has been presented in traditional and official church publications. In a session yesterday entitled Seeing the Seer with New Eyes, Revisioning Joseph Smith, Lance Owens said, quote, "A prophet's history flows from two springs, one above and one below, both melding in currents of his life. What story from above the prophet may have heard will remain his secret, the history no man knows. But by turning to the larger realm of prophetic history and its occult legacy, the record of its aspirations, its symbols and lore, and the enigmatic histories of the men and women who have been caught in his unique human experience, we may begin to find a methodology that leads us to a new wonder into the unknown history of Joseph Smith. In spite of the fact that some will continue to insist on seeing Joseph Smith in extreme terms, it seems likely that some moderation of those extremes increasingly will inform our views of him. If, as he said, no man knows my history, we can either believe that some woman will come to know his history, or more likely that he will continue to defy easy categorization. Emerson said that every institution is the lengthened shadow of one man, while today he might add, or the lengthened shadow of one woman. It is clear that for Mormonism, that lengthened shadow is Joseph Smith's. That it is lengthened suggests something about the power of his personality. That it is a shadow suggests something about the difficulty we may have in seeing him with his amazing gifts and accomplishments, as well as his contradictions and complexity. In his presentation of the Why I Stay session of this symposium yesterday, Fred Christensen said, "We are best defined by the myths we believe." I assume Fred was using that term not as it is usually understood, that is, as something that isn't true, but rather as something that is true in a larger sense, the archetypal symbols, images, and stories which give order and meaning to our lives. We need myths, but we also have to continue to discriminate between those myths that move us backwards into darkness and those that move us forward into light. An idealized portrait of Joseph Smith, while perhaps necessary in the early stages of spiritual and moral development, will not serve us well as we move into the more challenging and complex kinds of discipleship to which we are called. It is easy to accept a prophet without faults or failings. It requires a more mature faith to accept a man as a prophet who may have had some of the same weaknesses and failings that we do. Joseph Smith was neither as demonic as some of his detractors have stated, nor as angelic as some of his apologists claim. That he was an extraordinary figure, one possessed of unusual gifts and powerful charisma, there is little doubt. But I contend that if indeed the day will come when, quote, millions shall know Brother Joseph again as we sing, then we will know him only if we see him in his full humanness as well as the holiness of his prophetic calling. I close with this image of the prophet with which I began. As this Janus-headed image suggests, with its left-right profiles, its contrasting light-dark imagery, and its echoing shadows, it is difficult to get consensus on Joseph Smith. The image we see here is literally positive and negative, facing the past as well as the future. We see Joseph Smith in the echo of shadow as well as light, and with his double image encompassed by the circle, which symbolizes the heart and the imagination, and the square, which symbolizes the mind and rational processes. Just as Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man is defined by both circle and square, so we can know Joseph Smith, see him in our mind's eye and our heart's eye, only if we, believers and non-believers alike, see him fully. Thank you.
equipment change. Will you sort of explain why we're having an equipment problem here?
Yes. Ron Romig and I have been wrestling with technology here using two computers because this podium is not set up to project images on that screen. So we're doing a do-si-do of computers here. While Ron is getting his material together, let me say that I have immense appreciation for Ron and the work of the Community of Christ. I grew up in the church in which the RLDS was seen as the enemy. It had been wonderful to me that in the spirit of Christ and the spirit of what I think the true restoration is, that we have become colleagues and brothers and sisters in the gospel of Christ, traveling parallel, not divergently opposite paths as I was brought up to believe. One of the things I remember from my mission, as a matter of fact, in the northern states as a 19-year-old, was having what I considered, as I look back on it, really respectful conversations with members of the RLDS Church. It was my inclination at that time to convince them that they were wrong and I was right, as I was my inclination to do that with everybody I met. Thankfully, as I approach my 70th year, I have shed some of that that inclination to set the world straight. I'm much more interested in getting myself set straight these days. How are we doing, Ron? While we're doing that, it is. I did try, by the way, but wasn't able to get images from the people who have them. They will remain anonymous. Of images of Joseph Smith from third world countries or the developing world. I'm very interested in that because I think that as we move into the complexity of an international church, it will be interesting to see those expressions that come out of indigenous and folk traditions of Joseph Smith and of the Restoration. Next year, I hope at Sunstone to present make a presentation of graphic images of the key events in the Restoration, the First Vision, the appearance of Moroni, the restoration of the priesthood, and the martyrdom. So that's another presentation I'm working on, which I hope by then it will have improved technology. How are we doing, Ron? And I must say that this glitch is done partly because Ron was kind enough to lend me his computer. There's that.
We're still not quite up with the computer, but it'll take a second to boot up because it's looking for a network. I guess what I'd like to say in response is that I believe Robert has done a really good job of providing a survey, a kind of quick overview of the images of Joseph and how Joseph has been depicted has changed over time period. I think in part that is because Joseph died young, and so we didn't see him age. We didn't have chance to create visual materials of him at various stages in his life. And so because of that, and because of the time that he died, in which there was just the beginning of the photographic age, there have only been, for the largest part, sketches or drawings or artists' depictions of Joseph. And those depictions, I think, have allowed for the kind of fluidity in the visual image of Joseph that we've seen. Let's see if I can get this to continue to come up while we're visiting. One thing that I could share while we're visiting is that through the years there have been sort of various images, thank you, that have tended to be sort of the favorite or the popular images. And I think Robert has given us a good, overview of that. I think the images that Bob showed us of Sutcliffe Maudsley probably would represent the earliest period, and the images that were the most popular. In one of the sessions here earlier this week, there, in fact, Laura McAfee Kipp's presentation, she talked about in 1843. Pictures of Joseph and Hiram being in Tahiti and hanging in the homes of one of the natives, one of the local residents there. And that must have been one of the Maudsley images. Probably we know that there were images both of Joseph and Hiram. It's hard to do this with one hand on a mic. Just a moment. Then, sort of at a little later period of time, we began to see some of the front view images of Joseph, and that sort of represented a little later development. The front view oil portrait that we've already talked about had a companion portrait, one of Emma, and unfortunately we don't know for sure who the artist is of this portrait. The original hangs at the Community of Christ Library Archives in Independence, and it's a very interesting document, a historical artifact. When Junius Wells visited Emma in the 1850s, he pointed to this portrait hanging in the mansion house and asked Emma what Joseph thought of his portrait. And Emma reportedly told Junius Wells that Joseph always said that it made him look like a silly boy. So that may be a suggestion that it wasn't Joseph's favorite depiction of his appearance. But nonetheless, it was the favorite of the Smith family, and Joseph III in particular. I've kind of jumped ahead here while we were getting set up. I just wanted to show you some alternative images that Maudsley had created. You see Lucy Mack Smith sitting there in the center, and on the left is Joseph III, and the larger image on the right is Frederick Granger William Smith, and he was the second son of Joseph and Emma, born in Kirtland. Then Bob already showed us these images of Joseph in his military uniform. There are two versions of it, both owned by the LDS Church Historical Department. It was created originally to accompany this map of Nauvoo, but even though the portrait was done in time for the printing of the map, it was left off. But in subsequent editions of the map, this one printed in 1850, it was included. And just a gratuitous plug here for Steve Buell's book on Sutcliffe Maudsley. If you're interested in seeing a variety of images that Maudsley created beside those of Joseph, that's a good source. Here again we see Joseph in his broadcloth and standing in his full length. There were also similar portraits of Joseph and Hiram. This shows Hiram holding the Doctrine and Covenants and Joseph holding the Bible. Then in the 1850s, this engraving was created. It's probably not possible for you to read, but the caption down below says that it's from an original painting in the palace of Brigham Young. So what we may be able to infer is either there was a Maudsley portrait that had both of them, or the two images that we were just looking at were both hanging, and the artist created that composite image. And again, we'll just take a quick look at this image. Now, Robert talked quite a bit about the stance of Joseph, and I think there's probably a good physiological explanation for the stance, and that is, of course, we know that Joseph had leg surgery, and one leg was considerably longer than the other. He walked with a limp, and I think this is the correct depiction, that his right leg was longer than his left leg. Interestingly, in one of the images that Bob showed, and I'm not going to show, the image was reversed, and it showed Joseph's left leg being longer than the right leg. Well, in fact, maybe, yeah, this is it. So you can see in this case, the artist depicted the longer leg away from the viewer, but I believe that the one on the right is the correct depiction. In addition to the one image that we saw in Bob's presentation of Joseph in the New York church newspaper called The Prophet, published by Sam Brannan, was an earlier one of Joseph in his military uniform, and then the subsequent one in his broadcloth or ministerial garb. Then these portraits have been identified for many years at the Church Historical Department as attributed to David Rogers, but when I visited with members of the Maudsley family, they have a distinct remembrance of donating these to the Church Historical Department in the 1930s. So we believe that these are also Maudsley's. He did paint oil in the later part of his life, whereas earlier in his life he was all pen and ink sketch and watercolor. Here's Brannan. Brannan created quite a bit of visual material for the church. We often think the church living in a black and white world, no color materials, everything simply almost like confined on the pages of a book. But this is The Surrender of Far West. He also produced a lithograph of Joseph addressing the Lamanites. And then the image that we saw just a little bit ago is McGailey's copy of Brannan's edition. So Brannan's was published in about 1845 and McGailey's came out in 47. Here's another interesting picture of portraits of church leaders at Nauvoo, 1845, and this is attributed to William Major. William Major was another artist that came to Nauvoo. Some people believe that he came after Joseph's death, and some people believe that he arrived shortly before Joseph's death. What's interesting about this is that Major is often credited with being the artist that painted the front view oil portrait of Joseph and the companion portrait of Emma. However, if you look at this portrait closely, you can see that Major basically copied Maudsley. If he had painted a front view portrait of Joseph, why would he copy Maudsley in this painting? And also, there was at that time an engraving of Hiram, and it's posed exactly the same way that Hiram appears in this picture. He even has him looking out of the picture so that he could copy the familiar portrait of Hiram rather than turn him around or have him face forward. So from my point of view, it suggests that that Major is not the artist of the front view oil portrait. There are some other interesting representations of Joseph on one of the letters in the LDS Church Historical Department. is this interesting wax seal that has Joseph's engraving. We have a large wax cameo that's 10 by 13 inches in size that was made in England and given to Joseph as a gift. Again, they're kind of based on Maudsley. This one we think is an actual original drawing from life. It was done by a fellow by the name of William P. McIntyre, and he also chose to depict Joseph in profile. So those are kind of a quick summary of some of the visual materials. What about photographic materials? Well, it just happens that a photographer did come to Nauvoo around the time of Joseph's death. We have this wonderful daguerreotype of Emma, and David Hiram shot probably 9 months or, well, maybe less than that after David's birth, so it would date it sometime in 1845. We have this daguerreotype of Brigham Young, and it's attributed to this Daguerrean artist, Lucian Foster, who is a member of the church. We have a wonderful picture of Willard Richards and his family. Then there's the famous outhouse photograph of the Nauvoo Temple. The outhouse prominently featured in the foreground. I guess we could call it the fence photograph. So, but apparently no pictures of Joseph. And then we have other images of Joseph that tell us quite a bit about his appearance, besides drawings and the possibility of photographs. And, of course, the death mass of Joseph and Hiram. There are a variety of copies of death mass that have been made through the years. The one in the top right is one of the more recent ones. A series of masks were made in 1953, and ones that we usually see on display are those earlier or are those later ones. But there are some over here, like here over on the left, that show quite a bit of an earlier copy of the mask. And you can tell by how much detail there is in about hair and skin features and so on, about how many generations away from the earliest that it might be. This one here is very interesting. This is the earliest image I've ever been able to find. There's a reproduction in the 1870s of Joseph's mask, and it shows a profile and a three-quarter view. What's interesting is that down here along Joseph's chin, you can see that his chin was broken and has been repaired in more modern masks. And the same is obvious in Hiram's mask, that at least in this in particular copy, that somebody dropped and repaired Hiram's chin. What's interesting about that is that a lot of the more recent artists have used the death mass as the basis of their depiction. So it appears that a lot of the details, at least having to do with the chins of Joseph and Hiram, are more speculative than what would be preserved. And what's also interesting is that on Joseph's death mask, you can see he has this interesting cleft in his chin that is always absent in later copies of the mask. Then just was alluded that the Maudsley images were very close depictions. They are very similar to the death mask, and you can see here an overlay in the middle and also an overlay over Joseph's skull that was excavated during his reinterment and reburial in 1929. Wanted to talk a little bit about the images that Robert suggested were a feminization of Joseph. And what we are looking at is the daguerreotype that has often been mistaken as a daguerreotype of Joseph from life. Here's a close-up of it. You can see that there it essentially is a photograph of the oil portrait. And because Joseph III liked that front view oil portrait better than the Maudsley, when Emma died in 1879, before she died, she gave the portraits of Joseph and herself to Joseph III. Joseph III immediately went out and had a photographer create this image that we're seeing over here on the right and began to sell them. He even gave a supply of them to Major Biteman so that when visitors would come by Nauvoo, that Biteman could help sell images and probably supplement his income. So these were made in five different sizes. One was almost the size of the original portrait and then stepped down in sizes. Joseph used this image then as the basis of the image that he created for the RLDS edition of Tullidge's The Life of Joseph Smith. Then when Joseph III came out to Salt Lake City in 1885, he brought the daguerreotype with him and had Charles W. Carter, a prominent Salt Lake photographer, copy it. And Carter made this variation. The differences in hairstyle and so on are basically attributable to the fact that the image was copied onto a glass slide, and then usually before the slide would be printed, somebody would do touch-up around on the slide to make sure that there were no pinholes or things, and they could vary some of the details. And so that's why we have the different details in the hair and so on. You can see that, again, there's a high relationship between the image of the daguerreotype. And this actually is Charles Carter's glass negative. It's still extant in the LDS Church Historical Department. And when you compare it with the daguerreotype, some of the same scratches are present in the image. That there's kind of an area in here where there are some scratches. The lighting isn't good here, but when you actually look at the two of them together, you can see the same scratches present in both images. So here basically we're left with this death mask. It basically has proven to be perhaps the most authentic representation of Joseph through the years. And I think I'll stop with that. And that way we'll have a chance for some questions.
We'll take a couple of questions.
This is Ron. I don't know if you've seen Shannon Tracy's. He says he has a photograph of the daguerreotype. Would you comment on that?
Yes. The Community of Christ Historic Sites received a gift from a family visiting Nauvoo in 1969. Of a daguerreotype, and they said this is a picture of Joseph Smith. And so our site manager at the time thanked them and accepted the artifact, but was not certain, didn't believe that it was Joseph, because it didn't compare well on first viewing with the oil portrait, the familiar oil portrait. And so it's been in our collection through the years, and currently there's an authentication process going on to try to find out the relationship between the photograph and the image that's contained in the death mask. My opinion is that there's a high correlation, but that still remains to be seen. Shannon has been involved in the authentication efforts and has perhaps not honored his agreement not to go ahead and use the image without permission. So at the moment, I don't know exactly what Shannon's intent for the use of the image is.
Two things. Number one, do you think that the patterns in Joseph Smith's images says anything about the cultures which produce them? And if so, what?
That's an interesting question. Before you get too far away, can you just kind of explain a little bit more what you mean? Which culture are you referring to? Okay. I think that partly it has to do with technology. As time goes on, new technologies become available. It's easier to reproduce images. Part of it is the availability of more and more artists who are interested in the question. And partly it has to do with religious society attitudes about Joseph and how it would be helpful to depict Joseph, and often in terms of helping promote the story.
A few questions about his speech. Was his voice bass, baritone, tenor? How fast did he talk? Did he have any particular speech styles? Did he tend to monopolize conversations? And kicking people down the sidewalks like Josiah Butterfield, did he shout and yell when he did so, or was he quiet?
Well, most sources, I think, tend to suggest that Joseph had a medium to medium high range voice. Certainly some of his descendants had somewhat more than medium or in height range, so that their voices sound a little bit squeaky. He also had a lisp, and during the tarring and feathering in Hiram, one of his teeth was partially broken. And during most of his life, then after 1832, he spoke with kind of a whistle in his speech. However, he did have the tooth repaired at Nauvoo, and they had the ability to make a very good replacement, and that may have ended this kind of the lisping sound that he made. However, it is interesting to look even on the death mask and see that one part of his lip is somewhat distressed, almost sort of showing that it had been damaged at some point, perhaps during the tarring and feathering. So I think, other than that, I think he was probably a fairly loud speaker, because he was able to speak to large groups out in the grove, and probably with quite a bit of energy and excitement in his voice, enough to certainly keep his audiences interested. And I think that he had a little bit of a temper at times, and probably reflected some of that with his voice.
Okay, thank you very much. We'd like to thank both Mr. Reese and Romig for their excellent presentation.